Welcome, everyone. I am delighted to welcome today Michael Strain. He is at the American Enterprise Institute and is the Director of Economic Policy Studies. Michael wrote a book a few years ago that just sort of, it was a very short book, but encapsulated the most important aspects of a debate we're having in this country that I don't think gets enough attention, namely the great debate over whether the middle class has stagnated in over the last several decades in American life. This claim that there has been no discernible increase in wages or life circumstances for the vast middle part of the country is key to the populist movements of both the right and the left. Michael, welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Great to be with you.
Okay. So right at the beginning of your book, you quote from two politicians, one Democrat, one Republican. Here was Elizabeth Warren, and Bill de Blasio, then mayor of New York, saying, across generations, Americans shared the belief that hard work would bring opportunity and a better life. America wasn't perfect, but we invested in our kids and put in place policies to build a strong middle class. We don't do that anymore, and the result is clear. The rich get richer while everyone else falls behind. The game is rigged, and the people who rigged it want it to stay that way. Of course, this rigged language was then central to Trump's whole appeal. And then you quote Josh Hawley, who said that Americans haven't seen a real wage increase in 30 years. So let's talk about that, first of all. You say that's actually not accurate. So tell us about that.
Well, I think it's not accurate in a couple of senses. So, you know, maybe the kind of broader, deeper one first. You hear this language about the game being rigged all the time. You hear it from politicians in both parties. You hear it from commentators and business leaders, public intellectuals, writers, media figures. And I think we hear that claim made so often that we're kind of numb to what's actually being argued. So maybe just to wallow in it for a moment, you know, the idea that some group of Americans has intentionally rigged the economic system to, you know, keep their foot on the back of the bottom 99% of Americans or the bottom 99.9% of Americans and is somehow, you know, expropriating the economic gains that should go to most Americans and stealing them for themselves is truly an astonishing claim. It assumes like an ability to rig the system that I don't think exists. It assigns motive to the highest income Americans or the most powerful Americans, you know, depending on who's specifically making the claim. And, you know, it's truly an extraordinary claim. And I think it is wrong in the deepest sense. You know, there is not a conspiracy. There is not a conspiracy on the part of the elite or on the part of the, you know, wealthiest Americans or the most powerful Americans to, you know, keep most people down, to keep the bottom 99% down or the bottom 99.9% down or what have you. Such a conspiracy would be impossible to execute even if that minority group of Americans wanted to execute it. So that's one sense in which I think that claim is wrong. And then a second sense is just more straightforward and more empirical. If you look over the last 3 or 4 decades and you look at the wages of typical workers or the income of typical households, you see substantial increases. Over the last 3.5 decades, the wage of a typical worker, the average hourly wage after adjusting for inflation, has increased by more than 40%. And that's after adjusting for inflation. You know, the inflation measure that we use takes into account increases in the cost of housing, increases in the cost of education, increases in the cost of childcare, you know, all the things you typically hear about. So even after taking into account all those rising prices, you still see a substantial increase in inflation adjusted wages for typical workers and incomes for typical households.
You cite other ways in which quality of life in general has improved that aren't necessarily captured in income data. Mm-hmm. So you have, improvements in heart attack survival rates from 1984 to 1998 yielded a 1-year increase in life expectancy worth $70,000, per year, I guess. And then, development of antiretroviral therapy, which of course became very important in HIV, which improved the quality of life for 1.2 million Americans. 90% of households have computers. From 1980 to 2013, air passenger, well, of course, this week it's a bad to mention this particular statistic, but it's still true. From 1980 to 2013, air passenger fatalities fell from 100 per 100 billion passenger miles to less than one. So there are all kinds of things that are improving our quality of life that, even though healthcare is a source of tremendous dissatisfaction in our society, the truth is that we are living longer, except for the deaths of despair, which we'll come to in a sec. But the quality of American healthcare has improved tremendously over the last 3 or 4 decades, right?
Oh, absolutely, and even including the deaths of despair. If you're talking about what does life expectancy look like in 2025, relative to 1985 or 1975, depending on who you want to talk to, they want to roll the clock back to a different date. So you get the sense that a lot of conservatives want to go back to the 50s. A lot of progressives maybe want to go back to the 70s. No matter which particular era you're the most nostalgic for, life expectancy has improved substantially. Health care has improved substantially. Health has improved substantially. And of course, these are just one, health is just one component of life. When you look at education, when you look at access to educational resources, access to ways to, improve your knowledge of the world, your knowledge of history. If you look at access to leisure activities, if you look at the comfort of homes, really any measure,
the size of homes.
I mean,
the time spent with children. You had a great statistic in there about how working moms spend more time with their kids now than stay-at-home moms did in the 1960s.
Yeah, absolutely, and leisure time has increased. Number of paid vacation days. The average number of paid vacation days has increased. And really, I think it's surprising to me that this is not more intuitive to people. And I found just anecdotally when I try to press people a little bit. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much of an effort to get them to kind of focus on the specifics here, for people to just acknowledge that, they wouldn't want to go back to the year 1975. This is something I do often when I speak in front of audiences. People kind of enter the room, with the sense that things did used to be better, and I don't think we should we shouldn't downplay that sense. That sense is rooted in real things, and we should take that sense very seriously. And so in an effort with audiences to try and probe that, something I'll often do is I'll ask them, who would want to, let's say I could wave a wand and send you back to 1955 or send you back to 1975 or 1985, would you think about what life used to be like back then? Would you actually want to do that? And nobody wants to do that. Nobody wants to do that.
From my own personal experience, I'm in my 60s, so I've been around a while. I remember what life was like for us in our own family in the 1960s, for example, where, my parents were renting the house. My mother was a psychologist and my father was a struggling professor. Okay. So they didn't have much money. There was no family money. We used to have to traipse off to a public laundromat every weekend to do the laundry. They would bring me along and bring toys for me. I remember this. Mm-hmm. This was quite normal for a middle-class family at the time. Most people, if you weren't rich, you didn't have a washer and dryer in your house. Just things like that where, there was one air conditioner in our house and you'd sort of get in that room. Central air is now taken for granted. I mean, just when I was in, just finished college, I lived in New York City. The prices of rent were so high that I couldn't afford to live in an apartment by myself, not even with one roommate. I had to have two roommates and we had to just get rid of the living room it was a two bedroom apartment, but we had to transform the living room into a third bedroom.
I did the same thing in New York.
Did you? Yes. And that was the only way we could afford it. And by the way, the apartment was in a horrible neighborhood and it was dangerous and it was dirty. And this was just life. That was in the early 1980s. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so I have a sense that, I don't know, maybe people, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe people just are not remembering exactly, how much, or not perceiving how much life has improved for most people.
Yeah, I think people aren't, their concern is more kind of amorphous and less specific. And I think they hear leaders talking about things in this way, and they use that language. But then when you kind of, push them on it, they back off. They realize that language doesn't describe the actual problems that they're experiencing or the concerns that they have. I think those concerns are real. The 2008 financial crisis, which, at this point was a long time ago. But I think that was such an important event, such an economic trauma for the nation that is still reverberating through our culture. It's still reverberating through our politics. It's not really reverberating through the economy anymore. But that took, 10 years, maybe
a decade. Yeah.
I think we didn't really fully shake that off until 2018, which of course was after President Trump was elected the first time. After the Occupy Wall Street movement grew up on the left, after the Tea Party rose up on the right. And so this kind of extremism in politics, this turn toward populism, the rise of Bernie Sanders, the rise of President Trump in both parties, I think really has its roots in the crisis. And that crisis affected well over half of workers, a huge share of households. And so that was a real trauma that we shouldn't downplay.
Yep.
And that we shouldn't, obfuscate.
Yeah.
And then of course, kind of just as we were getting our mojo back, just as we were regaining our economic confidence, just as workers had, you know, typical households had finally made up for what they had lost in the years following that crisis, we get hit with a once in a century global pandemic.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, extremely traumatic for a different set of reasons. And so,
right.
You know, I think people, the angst that people feel is real. The concern that people feel is real. It's important to accurately identify why people are feeling this way, because, you know, it's like journalistically important and historically important, but also, you know, for my line of work, much more importantly, like if you're going to try to address the problem through public policy, you need to understand what the problem is. Right. And if the problem is that over the last, you know, 30 years or over the last 50 years, the American people are losing ground, then the policy solutions are much different than if the problem is that we had this horrible financial crisis that was followed by a recession more severe than any recession we had been through since the Great Depression and the associated damage that caused. You know, those are two totally different problems, right, with totally different solutions. And we need to, you know, again, I think to address this, we need to know what it is we're trying to address.
So let's talk for a bit about the Trumpian critique, namely that, you know, we have American carnage, we have, you know, rusted out factories, you know, dotting the landscape.
Scattered like tombstones.
Thank you. Scattered like tombstones. That this was done because this has happened, this deindustrialization, as he sees it, this loss of manufacturing jobs has happened because of bad trade deals, and that the cure for this problem is better trade deals, more protectionism, more tariffs, etc. So first, if you would, you talk about automation. Talk about the loss of manufacturing jobs. You say in your book that some places did suffer badly, but a lot of places didn't. So spell out your sense of how much of that critique is fair and how much is exaggerated and not right.
So I think the vast majority of the critique is completely wrong. And let me explain why. You know, it used to be that most Americans were farmers, and now, you know, substantially fewer than, you know, 1% of Americans are farmers in the sense that we think of the word. You know, why is that? Well, it's because the American agricultural sector became much, much more productive. Farmers were able to produce a whole lot more food per every hour of a worker worked, or produce a whole lot more food per every per every agricultural worker. And that's because of changes in technology, changes in farming techniques that drove that productivity. That is what's happening in manufacturing. Manufacturing employment as a share of overall employment has been declining for decades. At the same time, manufacturing output today is, you know, basically as high as it's ever been. So, you know, when you hear that we don't make things here anymore, which is a phrase that politicians often use, and that's used so often that it's taken as a given by many, yeah, commentators and many you know, influential voices in the media and in the political debate. That's just not true. The United States is a global manufacturing powerhouse. We are the number two nation in the world in terms of manufacturing production.
What are some of the things that we're best at manufacturing?
We're best at manufacturing the hard stuff. The types of products that require a lot of technology to manufacture.
CAT scan machines, things like that.
Yeah, all sorts of stuff like that. And we are, we are a global manufacturing powerhouse relative to other nations, relative to ourselves. Our manufacturing output is essentially, today is about as high as it's ever been.
But with many fewer workers.
With many, many fewer workers. And the decline in manufacturing employment began many decades ago. It began long before the United States ramped up our trading relationship with China. It began long before China was admitted to the World Trade Organization. Efforts to explain the decline in manufacturing employment, as being driven by trade, the timing just doesn't work. So there have been some attempts by economists to try and quantify, how many manufacturing jobs we've lost as a consequence of trade with China. And, those efforts, I think, indicate that we lost maybe, 2 million or so jobs in the 2000s.
Is this the famous David Autor China
yes,
shock?
Yes, exactly, the China shock yeah. paper. And so, when you try and look at that on an annual basis, let's say we lost about 200,000 manufacturing jobs from 1999 to 2011. That sounds like a lot, but I think you have to interpret that number in light of just how dynamic the U.S. economy is. So in a typical month in the United States, 5 million workers separate from their employers, either voluntarily because they quit or because they're laid off or because they're fired for cause. 5 million workers a month leave their employer. 200,000 workers per year lost their job due to trade with China. In a typical month, 350,000 manufacturing employers leave their manufacturing company. Again,
employees, you said employers.
Yes, I apologize. In a typical month, 350,000 manufacturing workers leave their job. In a typical year, during the 2000s, 200,000 manufacturing employees lost their job. So, this is disruptive, obviously, to the people who lost those jobs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But in the context of America's dynamic labor market, it's not a big event, and was not a big event. Finally, you have to take a look at the communities where these job losses have occurred, and what's happened in these communities. Again, this is President Trump's rusted out factories scattered like tombstones across the nation, American carnage vision that I don't think we should just pick on President Trump. I mean, this is a very common way to think about what's happened to manufacturing communities. So if you go back, I describe this in the book, if you go back and look at the places in America, the counties that were heavily intensely manufacturing based in the 1970s. And you ask yourself, how are those counties doing today? The overwhelming majority of them are doing fine. A bunch of them have successfully transitioned away from manufacturing to new industries. A bunch of them are still engaged in manufacturing as a primary activity, and then there are some that are really struggling, and we shouldn't minimize that or or try and obfuscate that. There are absolutely some towns in America in the Rust Belt where, you know, they were kind of a one factory town or something similar to that. And they've been hit really, really hard as a consequence of increases in manufacturing productivity that mean that manufacturing employment opportunities have dwindled, or because of trade with China. There are some places where trade with China really did shut down a factory. And they're not doing well, but that is not the typical situation. The typical situation is if you look at a typical county that was a manufacturing powerhouse in the 1970s, that county is doing fine today.
About Pittsburgh. Sorry to interrupt, one of my sons went to Carnegie Mellon, and so I became a little bit familiar with the city of Pittsburgh, which was like the iconic steel town, right? The name of the football team is the Steelers. And they were heavily dependent for their workforce on industrial production, but they've transitioned completely, and it's a very vibrant
absolutely
place. You know, they have a huge healthcare. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, and the universities create a lot of employment. So they've been able to make that transition. Not everybody who was primarily industrially based has not been able to go to the sort of post-industrial economy, which is more services based, right?
And what I love about Pittsburgh is they've managed to retain that kind of blue collar culture,
mm-hmm.
Multi-ethnic blue collar culture. Despite, as you say, having transitioned heavily to healthcare and education. The healthcare and education industries. So those are three ways I think this narrative is wrong. The first sense it's wrong. This is not a phenomenon that began in the 1990s. It's a phenomenon that began decades earlier. The overwhelmingly most important cause of this is advances in technology, not trade. The second way it's wrong is that even when you isolate the job losses that have been driven by trade with China, you're talking about 200,000 a year during the 2000s compared to 5 million a month in a typical month. And so, relative to the churn in the U.S. labor market, this is not a particularly notable event. And then,
some people would say, I think it worth exploring for a sec. So if you were a steel worker or somebody in another kind of manufacturing and you lost your manufacturing job and you're 50, you don't have any other skills. That's what they say. And so it's not possible for you to become, a health technician or something else. What about those people?
Well, I think that's an important question, and the way that I think about this is, I think we should be taking very seriously the need to improve public policies to support workers who are in that position, but I think we should be agnostic as to the reason why they are in that position. Mm-hmm, so if you're a 50-year-old worker and you've been laid off, whether you've been laid off because of advances in technology where machines or software can do your job at less expense than you, or whether you've been laid off because of international trade, or whether you've been laid off for whatever reason, we should be much better at helping. At helping that worker to find new skills and to get a new job, and again, we shouldn't really care, I don't think, about why it is that worker lost his or her job. I think we are getting better at this. Federal job training programs have a reputation of not working. that reputation is very well earned. Those programs were not successful in the 1980s or in the 1990s. But over the last 10 or 15 years or so, you know, I think we're starting to crack the code a little bit about how to get workers a new set of skills and connect them with new employment opportunities. It would be an overstatement to say that, you know, like we figured it out and everything is working. But I think some progress has been made there. You know, I also think that we need to be thinking more boldly and creatively about this. And so, you know, we talk about kind of the job market and, you know, we talk about the unemployment rate and that's what you see on the front page of the newspaper when those data are released every month. But if you look across the country, the labor market in North Dakota often looks a whole lot different than the labor market in New Jersey. And, you know, one of the ways that that the economy has adjusted to economic downturns in the past really has been people moving. And so, you know, if you can get a great job in, you know, a different state or a different part of the country in the 80s or 90s, you know, it was much more common to pack up your car and move to get that job. Much less common to do that today. You know, maybe public policy needs to think about ways to help people to you know, afford a move or even just to provide them with information about job opportunities that are available outside of their immediate community.
We often hear about the red flags we should avoid, but what if we focused more on looking for green flags in friends and partners? If you're not sure what they look like, therapy can help you identify green flags. Actively practice them in your relationships and embody the green flag energy yourself. Whether you're dating, married, building a friendship, or just working on yourself, it's time to form relationships that love you back. BetterHelp is here to assist you in this endeavor. It's fully online, making therapy affordable and convenient, serving over 5 million people worldwide. Access a diverse network of more than 30,000 credentialed therapists with a wide range of specialties, and you can easily switch therapists anytime at no extra cost. Some people think that therapy is only for those who are deeply depressed or who have some kind of severe mental illness, but that is absolutely not true. We all have weaknesses or things that we need to work on, or sometimes you just want to get the perspective of somebody who is neutral and has heard it all. And that's why BetterHelp can be so important in your life. Discover your relationship green flags with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Mona to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Mona. I'd be curious to hear what you think is behind this reluctance to pick up and move. It used to be so much a part of the American character, you know, to be sort of ambitious, restless, on the move, willing to pull up stakes. I've seen people speculate that people are afraid of like losing benefits in one state if they move to another. What do you think? Do you have any theories about why it is that we've become a little bit more reluctant
to move? Yeah, you know, I think it is a puzzle, and so I don't think we really know or have great evidence as to why this is happening. My own view is that, you know, we are just a much wealthier society than we were in the 80s and 90s.
To go back to your original point.
Yeah. And so what do you do with money? Well, you know, one of the things you do, I mean, the way that an economist would describe it is you purchase leisure time, mm-hmm. right? You know, you consume more leisure. And you also kind of, you know, life is just more comfortable and you know, in a variety of ways. And I think like one of, you know, I think one of the things we're, I mean, again, to you know, talk like an economist about it, one of the things we are buying is a less risky life. Mm-hmm. You know, we are buying, you know, stability. We are buying, you know, maybe you want to use the word complacency. You know, those are qualities of our lives, attributes of our lives that are just much more common today than they were 40 years ago. And, you know, my sense, and again, I don't want to overstate this. I don't think we have a good answer to this question, but my sense is that's a big part of it. And I think as you mentioned, you know, that often gets tied up in the discussion of government safety net benefits. You know, I don't think of this as primarily a safety net benefit issue. I think it is much more of a kind of, you know, society-wide issue, because it's not just low-income people who aren't moving as often. When I was a kid, it was very common for middle-class families, you know, to move. And
absolutely,
and I remember being a kid. Some of my best friends,
your best friend, would move away.
And so, you know, if this phenomenon were primarily about the structure or the generosity of safety net benefits, then
you wouldn't see it in the middle class.
For middle class and upper middle class people. And so I just think as a society, because we've gotten so much wealthier, one of the things that we are, you know, quote unquote, purchasing with that wealth is more stability. And we are purchasing, we are purchasing a, you know, security instead of risk.
So it looks like most Americans have bought into the idea that the middle class has been getting screwed over the last several decades, and people are embracing either a right-wing populist or a left-wing populist message about that, or explanation. Right now, because of the election of Trump and the Republicans, it's much more the right wing one that's in the driver's seat. And so what's your sense about the solutions that are going to be imposed or attempted to deal with the problem that you say has been wildly exaggerated or really hasn't been accurately identified?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and in many ways, it's the $1 million question. And so, if you're, you know, why is it important to like accurately diagnose what's happening? Because you want to match the policies to the problem. And you know, if you think the problem, as President Trump does, if you think the problem is that America is, you know, on the losing end of bad trade deals, for example, then you know, like a natural solution is to really cut back on trade and to start trade wars with other nations. If you think that a big part of the problem is that, you know, foreign-born workers are driving down your wages and driving up your home prices and consuming all your public services, you know, then a natural solution is to dramatically cut back on immigration. If you're a progressive and you think that the problem is, you know, big corporations who are, too powerful and are kind of deliberately rigging the system against workers, then you think the solution is to, you know, have an extremely aggressive antitrust agency that busts up companies and stops deals from being made. If you're a progressive and you think the problem is, you know, big powerful companies, then you want to, you know, socialize medicine, you know, as a way to get healthcare out of the hands of the big powerful hospital conglomerates or things of this nature.
We saw a lot of that, by the way, with the murder of that healthcare executive. We saw a lot of that.
Horrifying.
Yeah, really horrifying.
It was horrifying to see people, you know,
justifying it.
Just horrifying. I mean, horrifying horrifying on a human level, also, you know, horrifying
as a symptom.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think that this misdiagnosis of the problem is driving a lot of really bad policy preferences in both political parties. Obviously, with the election of President Trump, you know, the bigger problem today is the Republicans, because they're the ones who are in charge. And so, you know, what do I expect? I mean, you know, we don't have to. One of the challenges that you know, folks like me faced in 2018 was, you know, you kind of had to like reach back to the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, you know, to really, you know,
make the argument that this is a bad idea.
The argument that a big trade war is a bad idea. Well, now you only have to reach back to 2018. And you know, what happened the last time around, President Trump's first term trade war increased consumer prices. It reduced manufacturing employment opportunities. It reduced the competitiveness of U.S. manufacturing companies.
Gave away markets like to Brazil and others for agricultural products.
Absolutely, it really hurt our farmers. To the point that President Trump had to you know, bail them out. We had to have a big round of agricultural subsidies. And so, you know, this was a lose-lose. I mean, nobody won. And you know, I expect that the same thing's going to happen this time around. I mean, it's a little bit challenging to discuss any specifics because the situation evolves so much so rapidly. So at the time you and I are having this discussion, we're expecting that sometime today President Trump is going to announce 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, exactly what he did the first time around in his first term. President Trump threatened to put 25% tariffs on imports from China and Mexico a few days ago, and then you know, backed off that, but
Canada and Mexico.
I'm sorry, Canada and Mexico. But then backed off that and still left the threat dangling out there. He paused those tariffs for a month. You know, another thing that happened in President Trump's first term as a consequence of these tariffs is all the uncertainty around what our trade policy would be led to a kind of freezing up of business investment spending, because businesses couldn't make plans. They didn't know what the policy environment was going to be, and this was particularly challenging for businesses that do a lot of importing. I suspect we're going to see something similar happening this time around as well.
Can you explain why business is so giddy then about a Trump second term?
Yes, I can. And I think there are, well, I can try. I think there are reasons for businesses to be optimistic. I think they are putting too much weight on the good things and not enough weight on the bad things. But there are some good things. And some of these good things are correcting the populist impulses of the Biden administration. Yeah. And the populist excesses of the Biden administration. And so one of the things President Trump wants to do is substantially increase domestic energy production in the United States. That is a good thing. And that will reduce energy costs facing households and businesses. That will obviously be very helpful to energy producers. And that's happening at a time when many businesses anticipate that they're going to need a lot more energy than they previously thought because of advances in artificial intelligence and investments in AI technology. So that's I think
which uses a lot of electricity.
Which uses a lot of electricity, yeah. So that's I think one big part of it. You know, the Biden administration, one of the areas of populist excess in the Biden administration was throwing out the last half century of antitrust scholarship around competition policy that you know really kind of created a bipartisan consensus that the Clinton administration followed, the Bush administration followed, the Obama administration followed, that the purpose of antitrust enforcement was to increase the welfare of consumers.
And this is the Robert Bork thesis.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. So, you know, the idea that, you know, how do you tell if an industry or a market is competitive? Well, you know, is there pressure among businesses in that market to lower prices as far as they can? Is there pressure to push prices to be closely in line with costs? Is there pressure on businesses to innovate, both in terms of the quality and variety of the products that they're producing?
And the Biden administration approach was?
The Biden administration approach was to set aside that consumer welfare standard and to instead adopt a, you know, what could be described as a big is bad standard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, one of the things that happens when a company gets big is that it can produce goods and services more efficiently. But sometimes when a company gets big, it's, you know, like Standard Oil was, where it becomes complacent and it's not competing for its consumers.
Ma Bell.
Best interest. Yeah, exactly. And so, what I think we learned and what the federal government has been using over the half century prior to Biden's presidency was to kind of be agnostic about the size of a business and say, well, sometimes like big is bad and sometimes big is good, and we need to actually look at other things.
Okay, let's move beyond antitrust, if you will, because I want to discuss the way the Trump administration is approaching all of this. So there are some good things I think you and I would agree about the Trump ideological approach. You know, I think on antitrust, they're probably more right than wrong. Mm-hmm. On certain other issues as well. I think most people would agree that there is fat and waste and there are problems in federal programs. But what we are seeing right now is an absolute like attack that is using a, you know, meat cleaver rather than a scalpel to go into huge agencies and departments and just eliminate them or, you know, and so it, in line with what you were saying a minute ago about uncertainty, how as an economist do you see this incredible level of disruption? We don't know how it's all going to play out. It's obviously going to be challenged in the courts. So people won't know where they stand vis-a-vis some of these government agencies, the rules they promulgate, the people they employ, the things they purchase. All of those things are being thrown into mass confusion. So comment on that, if you would.
Yeah, I think it's concerning. As you say, a lot of this is going to be addressed by the courts. You know, similar to the trade situation, it's very fast moving. As we're having this discussion, the courts have already stepped in and tried to stop some of what the Trump administration wants to do with the Treasury Department, tried to stop some of what the Trump administration wants to do at USAID. But we don't know how this is all going to play out. And over the weekend, Vice President Vance indicated that the administration is at least considering ignoring court orders that it does not agree with. And, you know, I think that this is something that we should be seriously concerned about, you know, as citizens. It's also something that we should be seriously concerned about from an economic perspective. The rule of law and the certainty that the rule of law provides is a foundation of long-term prosperity in this country. You know, it is kind of amazing.
And other countries, right? And I mean, you can look at it internationally too. When a country has rule of law, it's a much better investment prospect than a country that, yeah.
I mean, it's kind of amazing when you think about it that you can, you know, walk into a car rental store and you can give them a 16-digit number on a piece of plastic in your wallet, and, you know, they will give you like a $60,000 object that you then drive away with.
Yes. Right?
And you know, we take things like that for granted. But the level of trust in institutions, the level of trust in the rule of law, the level of trust that if somebody breaks the rules in a way that harms you, you're going to be made whole financially.
By the way, that credit card company that is, you know, going to pay the car dealer has incredible safety rules built in. They have security. They tend to know if it's not you holding that card, but somebody else. This recently happened to me.
Yes, happened to me last week.
Same. And they know that they can resort to courts for adjudication of disputes. And all of that is just so foundational to the things we take for granted.
It is. And I think, you know, thinking about that and how it's evolved over time is instructive. I mean, I remember back in the 1990s, if you got your credit card stolen, it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And it was hard to deal with. And you had to talk to the police.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
And you had to talk to every single vendor that you might have used and, you know, explain. And
Yes. And so fast forward 30 years to today, we had our credit card stolen. My wife and I had our credit card stolen last week. I got on the phone with the credit card company. And they said, okay, which of these charges are yours? And I told them, and they said, which are not yours? And I told them, and they're like, all right, you know, we'll give you a credit for, you know, the
exactly.
ones that are yours. And, and, you know, we'll have your, you know, they said, we'll have your new card to you in 5 to 7 days.
Yeah.
I said, can you do it faster than that? They said, how about two? You know, and so it's remarkable. And that, you know, the strength of that institution is stronger than it was 30 years ago.
Right.
And as a consequence of the strengthening of institutions, in America, we are richer. And, you know, that's not just like an abstract.
And less stressed too.
Yes. And that means that people have better healthcare. It means that people have better education. It means that people live longer. It means that the quality of life is higher as a consequence of strengthening institutions. This is not, you know, I think a lot of times these debates sound like, you know, they're all about, you know, some, you know, number, some GDP number in a 23-page, you know, government PDF report. And of course they are, but like that number, you know, that number translates into a higher quality of education, higher quality of healthcare, longer lives, more leisure time, more time to spend with your loved ones.
So I completely agree, though. I could hear somebody listening to you and saying, oh, I don't know, education is really a problem. First of all, K-12, mm-hmm. not so great. We've been stagnating, if not drifting below other countries. Mm-hmm. And at the university level, at least the elite universities, not so much most of them, but the elite universities have become, you know, just terrible ideological indoctrination factories. So respond to that if you would.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree. You know, again, I think you have to think about the time horizon. And so Absolutely. If you look at, we actually just had some data on this last week. If you look at math and reading scores for young school kids, they are in a bad place as a consequence of classrooms being closed in 2021.
And they weren't great before that.
They weren't, but they were trending up, and yeah. now they're trending down. When it comes to universities, of course, I agree that there are huge problems at American universities. At the same time, you know, I think it's very important not to overstate this. And so, you know, if you are a history major in the year 2025, it was probably better to have been a history major in 1995. The quality of education that you receive in your history class, in your history degree, was probably higher 3 decades ago than it is today. But if you are an engineer, if you are a computer scientist, if you are a finance major, if you are a marketing major, if you are in any sort of biomedical sciences, if you're pre-med, if you're, you know, any of these degree programs, you are getting a much, much, much higher quality of education today than you were 30 years ago. And, you know, there's a sense in which the market here is working. You know, college students are majoring in the humanities less and less. They are majoring in these other fields more and more. And, you know, they're kind of voting with their feet. And so I think a lot of, you know, there's a lot of attention that's placed on, you know, what's happening in the humanities, what's happening in some of the social sciences like sociology. And that attention is valid. And we should, you know, that's a problem, and universities need to take it seriously, and they're not taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. And I'm 100% with conservatives on that. But I do think that a lot of the conversation about what's happening in college classrooms is ignoring what's happening in the majority of college classrooms. Right.
I think that's completely fair. And I do think we spend way too much attention on Harvard and, you know, the elite schools.
Yeah, that too.
And give a very false impression about what's going on in most colleges, which, yes, you know, most of them are not the Ivy League.
Yes.
And they're very, very different. Yeah. But I want to get your sense, if you can, of do you feel that there is a sense of foreboding or even panic among economists like you, but economists in general, about the threats to the rule of law and to institutions? Because that's the problem of this moment, is that we are facing a real threat to those institutions that are the underpinning of our whole way of life and our prosperity, and to say nothing of our freedoms. Mm-hmm. But yet I don't sense, you know, that foreboding. You read the Wall Street Journal and it's like, well, you know, we could use a little doge at the State Department and at the Defense Department. And, you know, everybody is fantasizing that this is going to be some sort of mild, you know, reform instead of a complete assault on the rule of law. So what's your sense of the reaction?
So I agree with your characterization of the reaction. I think you know, most economists, certainly most business leaders, are not overly concerned about the situation. You know, I was very concerned about this in President Trump's first term, and I actually, exited President Trump's first term with greater confidence in the strength of American institutions.
Oh, that's interesting.
In part that's because I think January 6th was a horrible, horrible event. I think President Trump was trying to steal the election. I think he was very happy to use violence in order to steal the election. And, you know, it was the first time since the Civil War that power didn't transfer peacefully across administrations following an election. And, you know, it didn't work. And so kind of, you know, paradoxically, maybe in a sense, you know, because I was so concerned about January 6th and other things that happened during those 4 years, you know, I left with a, I left those years with more confidence in the courts being able to withstand these challenges, with more confidence in Congress being able to withstand these challenges, with more confidence in the media, you know, with more confidence in the military, you know, these major institutions. And I suspect that that is a similar view that many business leaders have. I don't think they would articulate it in the same way that I just did, but I think they kind of arrive at the same place. You know, when I talk to business leaders, I hear a lot of, it'll be fine. You know, it was fine the last time. It'll be fine this time. And I think they have a thought process similar to mine, though. Again, I don't think they would articulate it in the same way that I did. I think that that's my view of what's going to happen in the second term. But I think the probability of a huge catastrophe is substantially higher in the second term than it was in the first term. And I am substantially more concerned about it than I think most business leaders are. And I'm concerned about it in two ways. I'm concerned about it in terms of its like immediate effect. You know, President Trump flew down to the Super Bowl yesterday and, you know, made an ambiguous comment to reporters on the airplane about U.S. Treasury debt that many people interpreted as the president saying that we don't actually owe bondholders what they think we owe them, right? That, you know, the White House came in and cleaned it up, you know, but like, you know, an hour or two later, the White House press office came in and cleaned it up. You know, that's a problem. And we shouldn't be ambiguous about our obligations to our bondholders.
If people stop lending us money, it is Armageddon.
Or even if they demand 100 basis point increase in
interest rates.
In the interest rate. You know, that's a major problem. You know, President Trump is gonna have to negotiate the United States through a debt ceiling increase in, you know, 3 or 4 months. You know, that may not go great, and that could be a problem. And so I think business leaders aren't adequately assessing the short term risks on trade policy. The widespread expectation was that President Trump would not go through with it.
He was bluffing. They think he's bluffing.
You know, and I think that's being reassessed, and that's going to show up in equity values. And so there's the short term stuff that I think they're getting wrong. But then also, I think, you know, as we were discussing, this stuff really matters for the long term prosperity of the American people. And if institutions are weakened severely, if like all of a sudden, you know, the court rulings are, you know, typically followed, sometimes not, that sort of thing, you know, that could really have a big impact on, you know, not just the year 2025, but that could have an impact on the year 2035 and 2045. And we should be taking that very seriously.
All right. On that note, I will say thank you so much for joining us, for joining me. This has been a very, very enlightening conversation, and I appreciate it. And I hope we can check back in not too long and see how things are holding up.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. Great conversation. Great talking to you.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.